Let's get our Bibles opened again to Ezra chapter number 1. We just barely got a few verses into this section last time, so let's go back to verse number 1 and start over again, because this is the transition into a new phase in Israeli history. We are entering into what is commonly referred to as the return from Babylon. This is how it starts. Ezra 1:1. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, this is from a Jewish perspective. So this is from the time when Cyrus took on the title king of Babylon. Because Darius the Mede, who had taken the city of Babylon and was granted authority over what used to be the Babylonian Empire by Cyrus, has died. And Cyrus the Great has now absorbed all of the former Babylonian Empire into his larger Medo-Persian Empire. And when that happened, the people in Babylonian exile, as well as the few Judeans that were still left in the land, are now counting Cyrus as their king. So this is his first year, first official full year as their king. So the year is 537 BC, and it is prophetically significant as Ezra's book tells us. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of he who is by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. Now, Jeremiah's prophecy in chapter 25, chapter 29, was what Daniel had been reading in our most recent story. He had been reading that the Babylonian desolation of Judah and of the temple would last, quote, 70 years. And since Daniel, when he was reading that passage last year, was in the 68th year of his exile, and now we've moved to the first year of Cyrus the following year, we're now in the 69th year of Daniel's exile, which was the beginning of the Babylonian exile period. It is clear that the time is almost up for the prophecy of Jeremiah to be fulfilled. And so what happens is, he who is stirred up the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it into writing. Now, we'll talk about what prompted him, we think, in just a moment. But here's the text of the proclamation, which was included into the inspired book of Ezra. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, he who is the God of heaven has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he's charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judea. Now that is coming from the book of Isaiah, several hundred years previous to the exile, where God had named Cyrus by name for this task. And I read this to you last time. We're going to read it again. Isaiah 44:28, who says to Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He shall fulfill my purpose, all my purpose, saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple, your foundation shall be laid. Then over in Isaiah 45:1, thus says he who is to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I've grasped to subdue nations before him, to loose the belts of kings, to open doors before him, that gates may not be closed. And then we'll zip through to verse number 13 of that same chapter. I have stirred him, that is Cyrus, I've stirred him up in righteousness, and I will make all his ways level, and he shall build my city and set my exiles free, not for a price or reward, says he who is of the armies. So the Jewish tradition is that Daniel and other Jewish leaders showed King Cyrus this passage out of the book of Isaiah, where he was named by name long before he was ever born, and that God, he who is the God of the Jews, but also the God of creation, had an assignment for him to get Jerusalem rebuilt and to get the temple rebuilt and to send the Israelis back to their homelands without charging them for that right. And the tradition is that the moment he was shown these ancient documents with his name clearly written in them, he decided he needed to do exactly what was written there. And that's what prompted this proclamation. Let's continue with the proclamation. Verse 3. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judea, and rebuild the house of he who is the God of Israel. He's the God who is in Jerusalem. Now that's spoken from a pagan concept that gods were located in certain areas. They were regional. And so from Cyrus's perspective, Yahweh, he who is the God of Israel, he's centered out of Jerusalem. So Cyrus is giving the Jewish people permission to go back to the capital city and rebuild the temple of the God of that land. That's from his perspective. Continuing, verse 4. And let each survivor, in whatever place he sojourns, and from that phrasing, we know that even those ethnic Israelis from the northern kingdom of Israel that went into Assyrian captivity back in 723 BC, back in the time of Isaiah, they are now living in the Medo-Persian Empire. And so they are also being given permission to go back to the land of promise and help rebuild the temple and rebuild Jerusalem and reestablish the Jewish people back in the land. So let each survivor, whatever place he sojourns, be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods, with beasts, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. So Cyrus's note acknowledges the fact that not every ethnic Israeli is going to go back. It's only going to be a representative sample that's going to go back at this point. And actually, when we say the word go back, only a few people, very old people now, are among those who went into exile. So many of the people that are going to the homeland of the Jews have been born outside the homeland of the Jews. So understand, every time I talk about the Jews going back, I'm talking about them as a people group, not as individuals, because many of them had never been to the promised land until this decree lets them make it their new homeland. Verse number 5. I almost forgot where we were at here. So the people who decide not to go have permission to financially assist those that are going. And there's even an encouragement that they do that assistance. What happened? Verse 5. Then rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin. So these would be the oldest gentlemen in the families of Judah and Benjamin, which was the majority tribal groups that came out of the kingdom of Judah during the Babylonian exile. So some of these guys are actually going to be old enough that they were young people when the exile started. And the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God has stirred up to rebuild the house of he who is that's in Jerusalem, and all who are about them, that is, the people around them, aided them with vessels of silver, with gold, with goods, with beasts, with costly wares, besides all that was freely offered. So we have exactly what was given permission for. Got a bunch of volunteers that say, well, I want to go. I want to be amongst those that go back to the homeland of the Jews and rebuild the temple and rebuild the city of Jerusalem and reestablish our ethnic group, our people group in the promised land. I want to be among them. And then the larger majority that's not going to go saying, well, we'll pay. We'll help you on your journey. We'll help you on your reestablishment of Jewish land. Verse 7. Cyrus, the king, also brought out the vessels of the house of he who is that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and placed in the house of his gods. Last time we talked about these items, they were part of the Daniel story on the night the city of Babylon was taken by the Medes and the Persians, just a few years before the story we're telling right now. Because the number two ruler, the prince of the land, Belshazzar, had decided to throw a great big party and thought it would be good to bring these stored divine drinking cups, drinking bowls, out of storage and toast to the gods of gold and silver and bronze and wood and stone. And that's when the disembodied hand wrote across that his time was up and it was time for the transition to the Medes and the Persians. Well, Nebuchadnezzar had taken these things away as part of a demonstration at that time that his God was stronger than the God of the Israelis, that he could take the drinking cups of that God out of the temple at Jerusalem and put them in the house of his own god, Nebo, or Marduk, possibly. And they've been there, with the exception of the whole drinking feast thing a couple of years ago, this whole time. They haven't been melted down. They were considered special because they were devoted to a god. Well, now Cyrus says those things need to go back to the temple of your god. So take them with you. Verse number 8, Cyrus, king of Persia, brought these out in charge of Mithridat, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now, Sheshbazzar here is the man that is going to be the new governor of the Jewish people on behalf of Cyrus. He will answer to Cyrus, but he is a Jewish man taking care of Jewish matters in the Jewish homeland. And so he becomes accountable for these very special items. Verse 9, this was the number of them. 30 basins of gold, 1,000 basins of silver. Typically in the temple, gold and silver were used in connection with the shrine building itself, and bronze things were used outside in the courtyard. So these are things devoted to the temple shrine building worship. 29 censers, that is, things used for the incense, 30 bowls of gold, 410 bowls of silver, and 1,000 other vessels, and all the vessels of gold and silver were 5,400. All these did Sheshbazzar bring up when the exiles were brought up from Babylonia to Jerusalem. So all of this has been accounted for, and we talked about them being drinking vessels, and probably we should be more specific. Some of them were for the drink offerings in the temple worship ceremonies. Others were used to carry sacred items, such as the blood of the sacrifices, or the hot coals that were being carried from the altar of sacrifice out in the front of the building to the altar of incense inside the building. And some of them would have been used to actually carry the incense itself. So there's a variety of ways that these items have been used. But Belshazzar, the proud second ruler, had actually used them in drinking toasts to gods and goddesses. Chapter number 2. Now these were the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of those exiles whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried captive to Babylonia. They returned to Jerusalem and Judea, each to his own town. They came with Zerubbabel, who is going to be a key player, and I believe he might actually be Sheshbazzar as well, if I'm remembering correctly here. But Zerubbabel is going to be a major player in the rebuilding of the temple. Yeshua, or Joshua, who is the high priest. Then we have Nehemiah. If this is the Nehemiah of the book of Nehemiah that rebuilds the walls, then he doesn't come up until later. But it's likely that this book of Ezra is written in the time of Nehemiah, because part of his story is told later in the book. So he might be listed here for that reason. Sariah, Reeliah, every time you see an I-A-H ending in English, by the way, that's the shortened form of Yahweh. It's Yah. And so it's the divine name. So keep that in mind for all their names. Mordecai, Bilshan, Mishpar, Bigvi, Rehum, and Baana. The number of the men of the people of Israel. And then we have this accounting of the people. And I don't think that it is beneficial to us to just keep reading through all these names. It is a list, which I've actually reduced into chart form in my own chronological companion to the Bible, because that's more helpful to those in a Western thinking. But let's just look at how it's kind of ordered, how it's structured. It says here, the sons of Parush, 2,172. The sons of Shephatiah, 372. So we have the name of a person that went into exile, followed by how many of their descendants are now going back into the land of Israel. Down in verse 36, it starts focusing on the priests, the sons of Yadiah, of the house of Yeshua, 973. So same thing, same structure. The Levites are mentioned in verse number 40. The same chapter, verse 43, it talks about the temple servants. There were non-Levitical servants in the temple, taking care of business. And so some of the descendants of the people that were taking care of the temple when it was destroyed are now back or coming back, and they will be given the opportunity to work in that same job in the new temple. The sons of Solomon's servants are listed here in verse number 55. And verse 58 gives the total. All the temple servants and the sons of Solomon's servants were 392. So those are all tied into family trees. Verse 59 gets into specific places. The following were those who came up from Tel Melah, Tel Harsha, Gerub, Adan, and Emer, though they could not prove their father's houses or their descent, whether they belonged to Israel. So somehow they didn't have the paperwork. They did not have the genealogical proof text that they are ethnic Israelis. So they are going to come and be part of the rebuilding, but they are going to have to go through a reabsorption process. And so some of their family trees, at least the partial family trees, are mentioned here. Verse 62, these sought their registration among those enrolled in the genealogies, but they were not found there. And so they were excluded from the priesthood as unclean. So these guys had been part of the priesthood according to the stories of their family trees, but they couldn't prove it by paperwork. The governor told them that they were not to partake of the most holy food until there should be a priest to consult Urim and Thummim. So they can come, but they cannot act as if they're priests, including eating the priestly food, until a priest that God is speaking through by the Urim and the Thummim can clear the matter up. Now, does that mean that somebody knew where the Urim and the Thummim was? That seems to be what's hinted at. Now, did they genuinely know where it was at? I'm not sure. Now, for those of you that don't remember, the Urim and the Thummim were two stones that were kept in the pocket behind the breastpiece of the high priest. And they were used to divine God's will, to ask yes and no questions. Now, some commentators have suggested through the centuries that this was just simply a white stone and a black stone, or two stones of different colors. And one stone was designated to mean the word yes, and the other stone was designated to mean the word no, that the high priest would ask a question and then stick his hand into the pocket blind and pull out one of the two stones, and that would be the answer. My objection to that is that we know that the genuine Urim and Thummim at one time in the history of King Saul didn't work, which means it couldn't have been as simple as two different colored stones that you pulled out of a pocket, because that would always work. It might not be true if God was not talking, but it would always work physically. So I'm much more prone to believe the Jewish tradition, which was the two stones may have been of two different colors, but they were glowing stones. That basically the priest would take the stones out of the pocket, hold them in his palm, ask the question, and one of the stones with the appropriate answer would glow. And so you can understand why that would not have been working in the day of Saul and be obvious that it was not working. So I don't know if they knew exactly where these stones were, but if they did, it would have been really helpful in the reestablishment of a lot of the things here. Verse 64, the whole assembly together was 42,360. Now that sounds like a lot of people until you start thinking that the people that went into exile were probably 10 times that amount at least. And that group that went into exile has grown since. So it is a small representative sample that is coming back to the Promised Land. Besides their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 200 male and female singers. Their horses were 736, their mules 245, their camels 435, donkey 6,720. So you need all of that to move all of your things from Babylon to Jerusalem, because you're moving here permanently. These guys are immigrating to the Promised Land. Some of the heads of the families, when they came to the house of He Who Is that is in Jerusalem, made freewill offerings from the house of God to erect it on its site. According to their ability, they gave to the treasury of the work 61,000 darics of gold, 5,000 minas of silver, and 100 priest garments. So they'd kept the priest garments in storage the whole time they were in exile. Now they're going to be putting back in service. And then we've got all of this weighted gold and silver that is going to be used, perhaps in the building of the temple itself, because gold and silver is used in its construction. But also, some of it could be used to purchase things needed in order to build the temple. Now, the priests, the Levites, some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, the temple servants lived in their towns, and all the rest of Israel in their towns. So Jerusalem was a ruin, remember. But now the people are coming back and they're occupying the towns in the area around Jerusalem where their ancestors used to live. And so they're reestablishing their old inheritance places, but then they're going to focus their attention on rebuilding the capital city and the temple. Now, how did they feel about it? It was like a dream. We know because somebody wrote a psalm, and that's what we're going to close with today. Psalm 126, which is subtitled as one of the Song of the Ascents. So it's either a scaled song or it's a song to be sung as you're going up to Jerusalem or on the steps leading up to Jerusalem. And here's the song. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. And then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongues with shouts of joy. And then they said amongst the nations, He who is has done great things for them. He who is has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our fortunes, O He who is, like streams in the Negeb. The Negeb is the southern desert of Judah. And whenever the wet weather season hit, the streams would flow with water and bring life to the land. Those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. And so they're going to reestablish the agricultural cycle, and they'll be crying about it because they can't believe it's actually happened finally. And then when the time comes to reap it, they'll be jumping up and down and celebrating. He who goes out with weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. And of course, we have some songs of a more modern period, bringing in the sheaves. But this was the time of excitement. The exile is finally over. The reestablishment of the people in the land has begun.